Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila, delicious and smooth tequila, meaning harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every element supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen in izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Blake Richardson, who is the president and owner of Motoi in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Motoi opened as a sake brewery and brew pub in 2008. There are around 20 craft sake breweries in the U.S. now, but when Blake started Motoi, there is not much information available about Japanese sake in English, not to mention other craft breweries to learn from. And Blake also runs a sake rice milling company called the Minnesota Rice and Milling, which is important for American sake breweries considering the difficulties in getting premium sake rice in the U.S. So today we'll discuss why Blake decided to open a sake brewery in Minneapolis, how he studied sake production, his sake making philosophy, why he started sake rice milling business, and much, much more. But before we start, Japanese is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Blake Richardson. Hello, Blake. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So I know you've been making sake. It's a seasonal. So how's this year's brewing going?
Very good. We actually got a bit of a late start, but the brewing season's been great. We actually finished our last batch of koji for the year yesterday. And so now it's just fermentation and pressing, and we'll be done.
Oh, wow.
But it went well, yes.
Great. All right. So first, for listeners who have met you, so where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
I am from South Dakota. I grew up there prior to moving to Minneapolis for university. And I grew up with the South Dakota staples of green bean casserole, goulash, pot roast, potatoes, corn, all the foods that you won't find at Disneyland.
Sounds amazing. And I heard that you got into beer brewing first before you went into the sake business, and you opened a brew pub called the Hakimer 1999, which you successfully run until 2020, which is amazing. So how did you get into beer brewing and why did you like it in the first place?
So when I was at University of Minnesota, I think similar to a lot of people, I was unsure what I was going to do after college. But I had been brewing beer for quite a while during that time. And I had a friend who lived in Denver, and I went out and visited him quite a bit. And the Colorado brewing scene at that time was just taking off. It was pretty energetic and dynamic and just wonderful. And so my love of beer just continued to flourish. And coinciding with that, graduating from college, in wondering what, you know, where I'm going to go in life, my friend told me that the friend that lived in Colorado said, my professor is starting a brewery, a microbrewery, and I know he needs help. And if you're interested, you could come out here and live on my couch and work there. And so I did that. And so that was sort of my initiation into the world of beer professionally. And from there, I came back home and found out, home being Minneapolis, and I found out that there was a brew pub opening in St. Paul. And back then there was no internet, so you know, I couldn't look and see who's opening it and what the address was so I could go down and apply. I literally just got in my car and drove up and down the streets of St. Paul until I found some tanks in the window. And I went in and applied and applied again and applied again, eventually got the job. And so that, I think that was circa like 22 years old, give or take. And then from that then on, I was, you know, brewing professionally, and that's how it all started.
Right. Sounds like kind of like a movement, right? So making something from scratch, kind of craft movement back then.
Yeah. The alchemy of beer and the culture of beer and the move. I mean, yeah, the four states that were just taking off in the brewing scene back then were California, Oregon, Washington, and Colorado. And, you know, being out there in Denver and just being a part of that, looking at all these breweries that were just doing such amazing things, it was very energetic. It was a very exciting time.
Right. And I think that the spirit still continues throughout the country. But you got into Japanese sake eventually. So how did you get into Japanese sake? How did you come across Japanese sake?
Yeah. So shortly after my tenure at that brew pub in St. Paul, I went to Siebel Institute and got a brewing degree. And then I opened Herkimer. And that was 1999. And about 2 years into the Herkimer being opened, around the corner, a Japanese restaurant opened called Fujiya. And Fujiya had been around in the state for decades. But it had changed locations several times. And this time it changed to the Herkimer's neighborhood. And it was a wonderful place. And we had several staff that were working there as well, working at the Herkimer and working at Fujiya. And I literally knew nothing about Japanese cuisine. I knew nothing about Japanese sake. I was completely in the dark on those subject matters. So I went over there and sat at the bar, and I knew the bartender because he worked at a brew pub up the street called Rock Bottom. And I said, Jason, just put some things in front of me and I'll tell you when to stop. And I ended up tasting for the first time Japanese sake. And I was pretty blown away. He poured me Musumi Junmai Ginjo. And I just thought, wow, what is going on here? And I'd never even had atsake before. So this is my first introduction. And I was pretty amazed. And so then it was just sort of this quest of like, well, what is sake? I mean, I knew it was not distilled. And I knew it was made of rice. But that's about all I knew at that moment. And then I sort of went on this quest to learn more. And so in that process, you know, I thought, well, I'll just go to a, you know, Japanese brew pub on the West Coast and hopefully get a tour and, you know, talk to a brewer or a sake maker. I didn't know what they were even called back then. And, you know, looking on the internet, I'm like, there's no sake brew pubs. I mean, that seems crazy. There's why not? And so that's how this whole thing got started. But yeah, that was my first introduction. It was quite a moment, quite a moment.
Right. And a perfect sake, Masumi Junmai Ginjo. What a great start. So
yeah, yeah, truly.
Right. And then, so you opened a Motoi, your own brewery and brew pub in 2008. And I know that, like you said, there's not much going on, like not the brewer, but know that one of the biggest sake producers in Japan, Gekkeika, opened its production facilities in California. I think it's 1989. And a much smaller sake one, which was a joint venture with Momokawa Brewing in Japan, and it opened its kura in 1997. So back there was nothing going on almost. So, but were there any other craft sake breweries in the US, or you were the first?
Well, you know, I don't know how to define that, but we were certainly the smallest, and we were certainly committed to using as many different rice varieties as we could get our hands on and milling rates. And that really was a differentiation between what we were trying to do and what everybody else was doing at the time. Most people were using Calrose 60 or 70. And we started out using every Japanese varietal that we could get our hands on that was grown in California, which consisted of Hito and Sasanishiki and Koshiakari, Akita, Komachi. So, yeah, so we were committed to this sort of how many different flavors can we, you know, make in our brewery, and how many different milling rates can we use. It was just you know, the classic what a brew pub should be all about. It should be as much variety as possible, and so if that's sort of puts me in the craft category, I would say then yeah, we were certainly the first to go down that road.
Interesting, because the varieties you mentioned, these are the premium table rice, right, for eating, not for sake rice.
Yes.
But you really did, because there's not much going on in terms of sake rice growing in the States back then, I believe. So you are the most kind of forward-minded pioneering thing. And then Japanese will probably never thought of making sake, premium sake, with table rice. But I think American producers have been really making them surprised, and even up to now. So, yeah, you definitely are one of the top pioneering mindset back then. So, but how did you study sake production? I know you knew how to make beer, but how did you study specific way to make such a, you know, well-recognized sake now?
Yeah, so in the beginning, the first steps for me to try to understand sake brewing was to read as much as I could, which the first place I started was John Gauntner's books, which is really not about sake brewing, but more about the culture and the appreciation of sake. But I managed to get him on the phone, and I said, what can you in the classes that you teach, what do you teach? And is there a way for me to sort of figure out how to brew sake through what you teach? And he was very candid, and he said, that's definitely not what I teach. But nonetheless, I went over to Japan to study with John when he offered his courses over there. He still does, just a little bit of a break right now due to COVID. But, the beauty of going over there was that we toured breweries, and I think each time I went over there and studied with him, we went to, I think, three or four breweries each day in the last 2 days of a 5-day course. And that was fundamental, that just being in a brewery and looking around and seeing what the actions of the people are, and seeing, you know, a pump connected to a hose, connected to a tank, in sort of building this framework of understanding of just how the process is laid out. That's really how it all started. And I went and studied with John. I took class one twice, not because I'd failed the first time, but I just wanted to do it again. And then I took his second course, which I think was a couple of years later when he introduced this, the second course, the professional course. And so that was building the framework. And then, of course, downloading papers and translating them into English and just anything that I could get my hands on from a research point of view. And then I also visited a lot of breweries in the country, United States, Sake One, and had a lot of discussions with them about how their process, and sort of formulated a way to do it. A lot of mistakes, and but yeah, it definitely, all that background helped sort of pave the way to building the brewery that is Moto E.
Right. So listeners who have not heard of John Gontner, John Gontner is really one of the key people to increase awareness of sake, not to mention increase the number of super, super excellent sake specialists all over the world. So yeah, right? So John Gontner, G-A-U-N-T-N-E-R, John Gontner, I heard he's offering online courses or maybe in the US, but he really is just amazing person himself as an individual too. So he came to the show when we just started the show in 2015, but yeah, I'm a big fan of his too.
Likewise.
Yeah, but I'm curious though, what do you see having beer brewing experience and then you started sake making? Is there anything related or kind of really beneficial, or is anything surprising between the two, differences or similarities?
Yeah, the basics that are the same is, you have grain and you have water and you have hoses and pumps and you got to keep things extremely clean. And you have yeast. I mean, so there's a lot of similarities in sort of this, thousand foot view. But when you get down to it, the way that you convert starch into sugar is dramatically different. And the way that you ferment is different. And, the unique thing about sake is multiple parallel fermentation. And so when I talk to a beer brewer, for instance, who doesn't know anything about sake, I say to them, imagine you mash in to your mash tun with grain and you use cold water and then you pitch your yeast. And that's a very inquisitive look that I get every time I say that. But that is the closest, simplest way to say how they're different, really. Because you make all your sugar water up front with beer and then you ferment it downstream. And then with sake, you're making sugar and fermenting at the same time in the same tank. And it's dramatically different in that regard.
Right. And the magic, the key component is koji, right? So, right, that's the thing, like why Toji, like you, brewmaster, has to really work delicately with koji. That's your partner, could be an enemy at the same time. So,
yeah, koji is just so critical and so equally fascinating at the same time, and a lifelong study for sure.
Right, it's like a judo, kendo, the way of everything is lifetime students. So sake making sounds like it's another way of spiritual martial arts and something. But how supportive are the Japanese sake breweries of your success in the US? Because they could be potentially competitors, but when you visited them, or how are they supportive to you?
I think overall the support is been fantastic. I've been lucky enough to visit so many breweries and talk to so many brewers. I've been lucky enough to work at breweries, and the the wealth of knowledge that I've gained through that experience has just been fantastic. And I wouldn't want to speak for them as to why that they've been so generous, but I suspect that there's this understanding that, you know, sake is an amazing beverage and should be shared by everybody on the planet. And anyone who wants to be a steward of high quality sake should be, you know, helped and taught the ways of making high quality sake. And that's the feeling I get. And like I said, I've been very lucky and received a lot of support over the years.
Right. Do you have any specific brewmasters that you're friends with or you call your sensei?
Well, like I said, I've been lucky enough to go to several breweries. And right now, the last one I was at was at Skinawa in Iwate, where Hiroko, an amazing brewer up there, had shared just unbelievable amount of information. And I was so lucky to learn the ways that they make koji. And that was the focus of why I was there. I was interested in the nuances of koji making. And I was really interested in a northern area brewery, which they are they're in Iwate, so they're very northern Japan. And she shared a ton of information. But prior to that, I was at Watanabe in Gifu. And same thing, Cody and company down there were extremely generous with everything that they shared with me. And I learned so much. So multiple people, if I would say, are mentors of mine.
That's amazing. I think it's inspiring to them to talk to you as well, because it's such a tradition-driven industry. And then new generation is necessary to be pumped into the whole industry to stay authentic as well as relevant. So yeah, I think it's mutual. You're benefiting to each other. So
definitely.
Right. Okay, so we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll dive into Blake's sake making philosophy. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit Korin.com.
I'm Chava Periwan, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainability-managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese on Heritage Radio Network, or HRN. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Blake Richardson, who is the president and owner of Motoi in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So let's talk about Motoi. So what are the theme and or the philosophy of Motoi's sake?
So the sake at Motoi, I would say, resembles, in a very general sense, sake of northern Japan. We brew very cold. We rarely go over 10 degrees Celsius in the Maromi tank. We try to brew for a long period of time, which is to say at minimum 24 to 28 days. And we go out as far as 40 days. We use a handful of yeast, from Akita Prefecture, which we get from Akita Kono. So these sort of softer, lighter on the palate sake is the driving force behind the idea of the brews that we make.
Right. Okay. So I'm sure you visited many breweries from north to south, but is that something that you really wanted to stay with in terms of the style of sake, which is northern?
Yeah, I think the brewery that has sort of influenced me the most in terms of a style and a philosophy of brewing is Saya Shuzo. I'm enamored with that brewery and the philosophy of the toji there. The no stirring of the Maromi, everything is genshu. I mean, it's sort of this very natural way of looking and letting the ingredients do what they do on their own with as little manipulation as possible. I just find that absolutely fascinating, and the sake is excellent.
What's the name of the brewery again?
Saya Shuzo, and the brand is Yuki Nabosha.
Oh, right. Okay. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. Right. Okay. So, do you call your sake on top of it the traditional creative or somewhere in between?
Definitely somewhere in between, because we're definitely trying to do things and think differently. But we follow the traditions. For instance, we use Ko-Ontoka, Yamahai, and Kimoto. I know some breweries will skip that step. That is absolutely imperative for us. We do not skip that step. I'm not judging those who do or don't. It's just for us, that's a part of an important part for us to continue on. For example.
Right. And you focus on nama and pasteurized sake?
Not anymore. We have nama, but I'd say 90% of our production is now pasteurized. We definitely started that way. We started by producing nama, but probably 2018, give or take, is when we made a major shift and started pasteurizing almost all of our sake. And we do release nama, like for instance, right now we're releasing a lot of nama, but it's more of a rarity than it is a commonplace at Motoi now.
Because you found a kind of terroir of Minneapolis without relying on one style, or what happened in 2018?
Well, so when we started, we had a bottling license to be able to sell sake to go, but we never really used it because of a couple of reasons. One, we eventually had a hard time keeping up with production. We were making enough sake to only supply the restaurant, but we couldn't supply it, people who wanted to take it to go, for instance. But then with a few key additions and some changing of the way we approach the brewing season, we then found ourselves having a proper supply to bottle. But I was reluctant to put nama in a bottle, you know, all the time. And I thought we really need to figure out how to take care of our sake post-fermentation from a perspective of being in a bottle. And so that led us to investing in pasteurization and sterile filtration and all the things that really take care of sake when it's put into a bottle.
Right. Okay. So basically, Japanese sake have main ingredients that rice, koji malt, like we discussed, yeast, lactic acid, and water. So how do you call the terroir of Minneapolis based on those five different ingredients? Is there any specific thing you find in your area?
Our sake is definitely softer. We have a soft water supply in Minneapolis, and it lends itself to be a lighter sake on the palate for sure.
Okay.
And it's, yeah. So like, for instance, you know, we make Yamahai and Kimoto, and they're, to get that like sort of extreme umami is difficult for us to do just because of our water supply. You know, we still do it, and I think it turns out great, but it's subdued. Our sake is very, it's not, it's just lighter on the palate, for instance.
Right. Okay. So maybe you can just talk about some examples of your sake and that represent your style. So I was looking at your website, and so for example, you have Miyoko, the description of which is ripe melon and mushroom flavors give way to earthy undertones and savory aromas. So where do you think the unique flavors come from?
Oh, for that sake, it is definitely the combination of the yeast and the koji kin that we use on that sake, and the rice as well. So that's Yamada Nishiki from Arkansas. It's number 7, and that is actually a namazake, and we use a special namazake koji kin for that particular sake.
Is it Junmai Ginjo? Okay.
It's Junmai. No, so Junmai. I think it's 70% mill rate, or say my boy, on that sake.
Right, meaning 70% remaining, 30% milled down. So,
yeah.
Okay, it sounds delicious. So what about another dalliance? A good name. Mm. It's described as orange blossom and rose petal aroma, apricot and pear on the palate. So, how do you make it, and where do you think this made it so delicious?
So that sake is much higher mill rate, 50% for the koji and 55% for the kakamai. And we use a yeast 21 from Akitokono and a different koji kin, which is for Daiginjo Brewing, Ginjo Daiginjo Brewing. And really that, I think that sake is an interplay between that yeast and that koji kin and that milling rate. It just speaks really well to the palate, and those wonderful flavors come out with a very long fermentation. That sake usually is 35 to 38 days long in fermentation.
Oh, wow. So the Miyoko and another dalliance, both are very fruity, sounds like. So that comes from slow fermentation and the soft water?
Yes, definitely.
Mm. Okay.
And the chosen yeast, yeah.
Right. So, and how about Junmai, Kimoto, Daiginjo? So you mentioned Kimoto earlier. So listeners, Kimoto is just the most ancient, but one of the most ancient styles of sake making style. So because you try to get the lactic acid from the air rather than inoculating the lactic acid with some added commercial products. Why did you decide to make this label in terms of sake, and What's the idea behind it and how does it taste like?
So Kimoto is, I think, very fascinating in the sense that it is difficult to make and it is ancient, like you say. It is a style of sake moto that has a very unique flavor. And I think the interplay with that, such an old school way of making a moto with a modern grade of sake, such as Daiginjo, is a really interesting interplay. So we make the Dikimoto, and this particular batch, we always put on the roof of Moto E for 14 days with the lid open in order to try to capture anything in Minnesota that will fall into the tank and propagate it up. So we literally have a little space heater out there to control, to bring the temperature up. And we always do this in March. It's sort of an interesting experiment that we do every year. Again, trying to catch something that's native to Minnesota that'll land in that moto and prop it up, and sort of, keep the flavor sort of local, if you will. But, and then, like I said, the interplay of that sort of, high acidity umami Kimoto with a very low milling. This milling rate is 40%, and trying to juxtapose those two sort of very different flavors together in one sake is the whole idea behind that.
Right. And by the way, this Junmai Kimoto Daiginjo description is rich layered flavors of nectar and caramel with dry bold finish. Sounds like you can pair this with some other kind of food. So, I really wish I could go to your brew pub, because your sake is basically only available at your brew pub, right? Or do you sell retail as well?
No, unfortunately, we do not sell retail. We only sell at the brew pub. Minnesota laws prohibit us from distribution at present. Yes. Huh.
Is any plan like that? Unless the regulation changes, you cannot distribute outside your brew pub?
That's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. You can only buy this Moto E sake at our restaurant, and you can buy a bottle to go, but we cannot distribute at present.
Because you have a brew pub?
Yeah, so Minnesota brew pubs laws do not allow the distribution of the product outside the four walls, other than a retail customer taking it to go.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Something has to happen. Maybe I should write to your senator or something.
Please do.
Okay.
No, we're working on other options and have been for years. And, the possibility of us expanding or adding a different location or through legislation. We're definitely working on it. It's not like we're just going to let it be. We're working on ways to make that change.
Okay. So good luck and keep me posted. So,
thank you.
Yeah. And then you also run a rice milling company called Minnesota Rice and Milling, which you founded in 2012. So the website says quality rice milling for sake breweries, home brewers, and wholesale suppliers, and rice varieties Yamada Nishiki, Koshihikari, and Kalos. So why did you start a Japanese sake rice milling company?
Well, the landscape of getting varieties and different milling rates when we opened was so difficult. And we were lucky enough to find a mill and buy it. And it to me, it just made sense to try to offer all the things that I had desired when we opened in 2008, which is to say, I wanted to buy any rice and mill it to any milling rate. And that was just unheard of at that time in this country. And then on top of that, in any volume, can I just get one pallet of this particular rice at this particular milling rate? And that was not an easy thing to do back when we opened. And I thought, well, if this industry is going to take off, it's not going to be because of a whole bunch of new large breweries opening. And it's going to be a bunch of small breweries that open across the country. And they're going to say the same or think the same thing that I thought when we opened. Wouldn't it be nice if we had this rice at this milling rate in this amount? And so it just made sense to try to answer that problem or, you know, provide that for future breweries that we're going to open. And certainly Moda, we benefited from it just because, you know, again, we wanted to be known for our varieties and have different milling rates and have different rice varieties. So,
Yeah. Wow. So I'm sure a lot of psychic breweries in this country worshiping you because you really felt the need for them. So, and how does it work? So do you buy rice from farms and you mill it to by your bio-specified milling rate and the quantity, or how what's the business model here?
So right now we work with Isbell Farms in Arkansas, and we buy the rice from them and we mill it to order. So if a brewery says, hey, I would like to get this rice, Yamada Nishiki or Omachi, mill to 55%, well, then we will in turn mill it for them in the amount that they want. But we, like you say, we mill to order. We don't do anything ahead of time. It just depends on what the brewery wants and what size they want.
Yeah, so who are and how many are your clients?
Well, we mill for quite a few different breweries. We just shipped some rice to Farthest Star and Nami in Mexico, The Void, Proper Sake, quite a few. Arizona Sake, Colorado Sake, a lot of different breweries across the country are using the rice that we mill for them.
Wow. So do you think you are the only sake rice milling company in North America?
No, there's another one in California that's also milling for a variety of brewers across the country.
Right. Oh, it's still only very limited. So, yeah, I'm glad you started a business. You're very forward-minded. That was 10 years ago already.
Yeah. It's hard to believe. 10 years ago. Wow.
Right. And actually, Nami's Matthew Gelpion came on episode 250. And also at Chris and Mark Isabel of Isabel Farm came on episode 244. And yeah, they are really important, right? So Isabel Farms is just a pioneering sake rice people and just good farmers for generations. So yeah, it's just amazing that how they're open-minded, forward-minded, and they have great stories. So yeah, I'm so glad you really are along with them, just inspiring the whole sake industry in North America. So congratulations.
Thank you. And I concur with your assessment on Isbell Farms. They're wonderful people, wonderful farmers, and they have fantastic rice. It really, it's a game changer for sure.
Right. And I got lucky to taste Nami sake recently, and they're amazing. So their sake, actually before the show, I couldn't get a chance to taste it. And I finally got a chance because they kindly sent me. And wow, it's happening. North America and Mexico, the sake is good. Something's good happening. So I was very impressed. So you're part of the whole team.
I agree. I've had their sake. It's wonderful. Really good stuff.
Right. Okay, so you really are not just you're making your own sake, inspiring the whole production side. You are really a kind of foundational part of this whole sake industry outside Japan. So so how do you see the change in demand for your sake rice since you started the company 10 years ago?
Oh, it's definitely gone up. We didn't mill that often in the early years. And now we are milling around the clock, it seems like. It's dramatically different. I mean, the the production has stepped up, and obviously the amount of breweries is dramatically increased too over the years. And, so it's definitely a lot more than it used to be.
Right. So do you tend to sell more Yamada Nishiki, which is a super premium sake rice, or some table rice, Koshikari Kalos, which also are premium table rice, and it seems to be very suitable making sake in this country. So which one is the most popular?
We definitely mill mostly Yamada Nishiki. That's the one variety that is definitely goes out the door the most.
Right, because it's a rare supply too, and it's much cheaper than buying Yamada Nishiki from Japan and shipping all the way, and it's not as fresh probably if it ships all the way from Japan. So
yeah, exactly, yeah.
Okay, and there are about 20 sake breweries in the U.S., and the number seems to keep increasing. So what do you think is the future of Japanese sake made outside of Japan as brewer yourself and also sake milling company owner?
Well, I think the amount of breweries are going to increase for sure. The beverage, the education of people, of sake drinkers is continuing to go up. People are discovering it and liking it. I mean, I see it every day at Moto E. People are amazed with the beverage, how it pairs with food, the traditions of it. It's on a trajectory up for sure. It's just a matter of how quick it happens, but it's inevitable that there'll be a sake brewery in every state, if not, you know, two or three. Sake is just an amazing beverage. And if once you people try it and pair it and enjoy, they always enjoy it. It's an amazing transformation of how you approach the consumption of alcohol versus beer versus wine. The interesting thing about sake, which is sort of, this country before sort of changed to craft brewing as an option versus macro brewing, if you will. You knew what both were, and same with wine. When the wine industry sort of took off in California, you had an idea of what one high quality wine was versus sort of the big jug wine, but that's very different with sake, because sake wasn't like an undertone of sake drinking in America at a mass volume, and so sake just kind of coming into this picture alone without this huge history behind it. So in some senses, I think it's going to take a lot longer for sake to take off than like the craft brewing industry did or the wine industry did. But at the same time, there's so many more avenues to education with the internet and exploring online what sake is. And I think it'll take a little bit longer, but it will inevitably happen. It's just a matter of how long it'll take.
So how do you see it at your brew pub? Are clients, your diners, guests tend to be more passionate about sake than when you open it? Or do you see any customer preference changed?
Oh, yeah, it's changed dramatically. The one thing I talk about when customers come in and they ask for a brand of sake, or they ask for a style or a grade of sake, that's a pretty amazing transformation for just someone coming in and said, I hear you make sake, can I try something? As opposed to they ask for it by brand, or they say, do you have a Junmai Ginjo? And watching that happen over the years, you know that it's, the sake bug is taking, people are becoming a part of the industry in a different, more meaningful way.
Right. Perhaps they started to go to more Japanese restaurants or traveled, or the internet information increased those things. Maybe they were triggering that trend, but it's just amazing, mm-hmm. right? It sounds like a quick change over since you started the brewery.
Yeah, so you know, another story I tell is, which I think is really poignant to this discussion, is when I was putting the plan together for Moto E, I went around Minneapolis and I talked to a lot of bartenders and a lot of owners of restaurants that carried sake. And what I discovered was is that their sake sales were way higher than what was being sold at the liquor stores in the same neighborhoods. In other words, people were choosing to drink high-end sake, not hot sake, but Junmai Dai Ginjo. And they were choosing to drink it in places where it cost more. It costs more to drink at a restaurant than it does to go to the liquor store and take a bottle home. And that I found that over and over again in the research that I was doing. And what I came to understand is that people want to drink sake, but they just want someone to explain to them what it is as they're drinking it. And that's fundamentally what a restaurant should be able to offer you with the glass of sake. The bartender, the servers, they should be able to say, you know, this is Junmai Ginjo. It's made with this rice. It has this profile. And so I think that I don't think that anything's changed from that research that I did in 2007, 2008. I think people still want to discover sake. They still want to understand it in a way that's meaningful. And the more this industry can do that, the faster this industry will grow. And I think, and you see that. You see that with people like John Gontner educating people, and how many people go to his class, and you know, so many other educators out there. People still show up and they want to be educated on this beverage, and so that's why I think for sure this will take off. But there's just nothing. There was like again, to go back to beer and wine, there wasn't a fundamental understanding of what the beverage was prior to entering into the sake world for the common, you know, just the everyday person who wants to try something different. They don't have that palate of, well, I used to drink this sort of low-end sake, but now I've graduated to high-end sake. That just doesn't exist. So just to come full circle, the more education about the beverage, the better the sake industry will do.
Right. And also each brewery has lots of stories to tell, and some goes back to like 500 years of history. Like, it's easy to understand why it tastes so differently. It's not manufactured in big factory, it's just made by hand. So yeah, it's just a storyteller we need more, and not just technical.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I obviously I didn't mention that, but you're absolutely right, because that speaks to the, you know, just the humanity of sake, like the people who work in the breweries, and their heritage, and their family story, and the community story, and the food that surrounds the town that makes this sake, and how that pairs. I mean, that's something Michael Tremblay's course, Sake Scholar. I don't know if you've heard of that course he teaches, but that's a fundamental piece of his education, is talking about, you know, this sake, this community, this food in this location. And that's how this sake grew to be, you know, paired with all the culture and all the food that surrounds it. And, you know, you're absolutely right. There's so many wonderful pieces to the culture of sake itself.
Right. Well, luckily, Michael is joining us next week. So on the show.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, he's got a new book, so we're going to discuss that too. And speaking of storytelling, like on episode 254, Genki Ito of Tipsy Sake, he has an online sake distributing company that's directly sold to consumers. And he really pays attention to storytelling, and he has booklet and all those things. So, I mean, little things, these things should be more available, or not just the internet, but also, I mean, of course, everyone wants to go to Japan and visit sake breweries, which is not easy, especially now. So, yeah, hopefully those educational aspects are going to be more and more available Yeah, because there's so many things that Japanese traditional breweries can share, and that's what they want too. So, and for I think you are a big bridge between the two cultures. Okay, so so what are your plans and dreams?
Oh, the in the short term, it's to continue to grow Moto E, continue to improve. We brew only in the winter. We reflect in the summer, and we try to make sure that we pick two areas that we can improve on every year with our sake. And, you know, obviously we want to grow the brewery to a point where we can start distributing our sake so other people can enjoy it outside of our immediate area. And, you know, we touched on that already, but that's a big focus for us for sure.
Right.
And then the education, like we just talked about, is key. And being able to share this wonderful beverage with as many people as possible.
Mm, right. Okay. So, well, maybe I should really write to your senator. Right. Yeah. So, okay. And so, by the way, if you want to drink your sake as soon as possible without waiting for the regulation change, do you offer a tour of your brewery if we go visit your brewery?
Yes, absolutely. Just email us on the website and reach out. Let us know you're coming. We'll absolutely let you come in, give you a tour. Actually, we're giving a ton of tours yesterday with the conference in town. It was so much fun. So many people coming through, and it's really wonderful to connect with people and just, you know, their ears and their eyes perk up when they start understanding the process. It's a very rewarding experience for hopefully them. And it certainly is for us when we get to share the knowledge of brewing.
Mm, awesome. Okay. So where can we find updates online and on social media?
So our website is moto-i.com. We are at MOTOI Sake on Twitter and on Instagram. And that's how you can track us.
Right. Wonderful. So thank you so much for joining us today, Blake. I'm sure you're super busy, especially just ending the brewing season as well. So thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@theheritagerelatednetwork.org or at kikuatema.com. Japanese is a weekly program and always available at heritagerelatednetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Armin Spengen, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.